Okay, hello everybody here, and hello also all the Serbs that are watching us on the live streams and all the people at home that cannot come here. We are four people who have done a fun project, and my name is Felix, there's Tilman, Georg and Mark, and we would like to show you the results of our fun project, which is taking over the Storm botnet. Okay, so there are some critical things about the laws, you know. So we can't really show you here how to take over the whole botnet. We would even get in trouble if taking over one single machine if it's not our own. So we can only demonstrate this with our own machine, but we can assure you this is really working in the real Storm botnet. Right, there are still too many people here, probably Leos as well. Any law enforcement officers here? No. Okay, and we will also publish our source code, but we cannot publish the full source code, like to have a ready-made tool, but we can only publish parts which are for research and stuff, you know, research. And right. Okay, and because we have done the work all together, we have also split the talk, and Georg is starting with a short introduction, and then every one of us is giving some details about a specific part and how we all did it. All right? So have fun.
Oh, great. So, hi everybody, I'll be starting with a very brief and high-level introduction to the StormWorm botnet. Actually, StormWorm is the most known name, but there's a lot of different names for this malware family. So there's PCOM and I don't know how to pronounce the others in English, but there's a lot of names, as you can see on the slides. And this threat was actually first seen somewhere in summer 2006, so this is not so new. Back then, in 2007, the estimated size was 500,000 to 1 million infected computers, which is actually, in botnet terms, not so huge. So there's other big botnets that are still IRC-based. But this one was new, and actually, the 1 million host estimate was, yeah, it was very high. So people think it was lower. But this was the estimate back then. And right now, according to our estimations, the actual botnet size is below 100,000. That is the botnet bots that we saw. So maybe we don't see everything, but that's what we estimated. So it shrank. And that is because back in 2007, Microsoft used their, authority to all Windows XP computers with the update mechanism and the malicious software removal tool to remove 250,000 infections they counted. So this was why the botnet shrank a lot, and also this means there was at some point at least 250,000 for sure, because Microsoft counted it like this. So what does it do? I mean, there's again a technically interested person running this botnet. Some people at first thought it was Russians running the botnet. Nowadays people say, well, they're using servers in Russia, but it might be actually Americans, because as we'll later see, it looks like they're real American cultured people. So what does it do? Well, it sends spam for profit and also for spreading. It performs distributed denial of service attacks, because either for blackmailing, but we didn't see that actually, but the what we saw is if you're a researcher and they think you're wanting to reverse engineer them, because for example you download a binary very, very often from the same IP address, you will just get a DDoS on yourself. So they're actually trying to protect their network. And then what they're doing is, of course, harvest email addresses, because this helps you sending spam. So how do you actually get this stuff on your, whatever that is? Infection vectors. Sample spammed as mail attachments. This is not very sophisticated, per se. So you have Mrs. Santa Claus. This was 2007, just before Christmas. So they say, oh, download the free strip show of this nice Santa Claus girl. Halloween 2007, there was a dancing skeleton. So if you click on this, you will have a funny dancing skeleton on your desktop. Hey, do this. Then someone, this or last year, there was also invasion of Iran. So they sent, oh, new news, USA invaded the Iran, and here's the video. Download this exit to show the video. So, but they are a little bit more sophisticated than just trusting on the average dump user. Actually, they are linking to web pages that have drive-by exploits. So you click on the link in the email, and then you're redirected to a page that has some exploits for Internet Explorer and stuff like this. And only if they determine that you're not vulnerable to all these exploits, they send you a raw link to the simple binary. So this is how you get Storm. If you're probably, the guys here didn't click on the dancing skeleton, maybe you clicked on the stripping Santa. But it's more for the average PC user that gets infected by this. Once you're infected, how does it work and what's new about it? Actually, StormWarm botnet is not a classical traditional IRC-like botnet or whatever. It's a peer-to-peer botnet. So this means you cannot just go to Russia or wherever, or China, and take down their command and control server and say, bam, your botnet is gone. This is what law enforcement is doing all the time with other botnets. But this one actually uses a peer-to-peer network for communication, and you can hardly take down all 250,000 or more StormWarm nodes per hand and say, now the botnet is gone. Yeah, Schäuble could, of course. What it actually does is that it uses this peer-to-peer network for finding the real command and control servers. So it's not really that a command and control that is only in the peer-to-peer network where commands are forwarded or stuff like this. It just uses this peer-to-peer network as a kind of replacement for DNS. So once a StormWarm tries to find new commands, what it first does is it goes to the peer-to-peer network, it bootstraps, we will see more about this later on, and ask, where can I find a command and control server which gives me these commands? And then, as you can see here, it's somewhere, it routes a query through the network based on a specific hash, and then some node knows, oh, the command and control server is over here, and then it initiates a second command and control connection that is TCP-based, actually, to a node that can tell him, these are the updates. So the actual commands are not sent via the peer-to-peer network, but they are sent via a custom TCP protocol that contains certain command strings and how to behave. So it's not fully peer-to-peer, it's not so super sophisticated. As we see, they actually reused a library that will be explained later on for the peer-to-peer stuff. So what they did, they took their existing stuff and just replaced DNS by this peer-to-peer network. Okay. This is old stuff, actually, StormWarm. I mean, as you see, it's 2 years old, and as it was new, many researchers got interested. So why did we care? I mean, this is boring stuff on the first sight. Well, actually, there was, except for Joe Stewart, who presented on this on Black Hat, that is what we know of course, there might be have been more at various antivirus companies, there was no real deep reverse engineering on this, because it's heavily obfuscated. It's C++, multi-threaded. Even if it wouldn't be obfuscated, it is a pain in the ass to debug this whole beast. So what people did is they just ran it in a VMware and looked like what it behaves. So this is the reason why a lot of the initial research was very fuzzy or just plain wrong or not very accurate, because people just took a sandbox, ran it in there, and did some dynamic analysis. And what we did, or what mainly Felix did, is the manual reverse engineering of the malware. And then we developed a solution to then overtake the botnet from the findings. So our new findings, just as you see, what we did, or what Felix reverse engineered, is first the generation algorithm for the CNC lookup hash, because others just ran it in a sandbox each day for 32 times or even for 200 times to find out what to search for in the peer-to-peer network. We just can give you the algorithm now. Then, how are these command and control hosts encoded in the search results? Because it's not just IP as a string and then the port or something, it's actually encoded there somehow. We can tell you how that is encoded. Then, how does the command protocol work? People just ran it in a virtual machine and said, oh, this is probably an update because it contains a URL or something like this. The reverse engineering now shows you what commands are there, actually. And then there's a challenge response. I mean, you could tell, okay, this is probably a challenge response, but you could not actually authenticate to a real command and control server because you didn't know how the challenge response algorithm worked. It's actually a boring SOAP, but you need to know that. How does the update command actually work and how to update? And then what we then did is we built a disinfector. So we don't want, if we can overtake a storm node, we're white hats, of course, We also want to disinfect it from Storm. So we wrote a simple disinfector that terminates the running instance of StormWorm, which is not so easy because it injects itself into services access, so you cannot just use terminate process for it. And then also remove the on-disk binaries of Storm. Yeah. And actually, we have working implementation code that is going to be released later today, that, for example, hatch generation C. And this are only pieces of the puzzle that are going to be released today. And later, maybe we will even release something more. Let's see. Or someone else will put it together. We don't know. And that's what we did. So what was very funny during this research was actually tracking the trackers. Because if you look into the peer-to-peer network, you see some peers are highly active and they do some eye-catching stuff. Because if you look at the hashes here, they're largely the same and they only differ in the first byte. So why does somebody do this? They flood the network with search requests. The reason is that they wanted to enumerate all peers in the peer-to-peer network to see which computers are infected. But the way they did it, instead of passively listening but actively pushing a lot of requests, was very, very noisy. So here are a couple of universities that actually made their hosts very visible. There's the University of San Diego. There is the Georgia Institute of Technology, the University of Michigan, and then the University of Mannheim, which just very easily revealed which hosts are crawling. So, I mean, if I would run the Storm botnet, I would just have DDoS these computers. And then also the Institute Eurecom was, as I know, used the connection of the University of Mannheim to do the same research. So they crawled this peer-to-peer network. And yeah, I would have done it more passively, maybe. But yeah, that's up to them, actually. So these are some interesting host names, just by the way. So how does this whole peer-to-peer stuff work? And let's get some peer-to-peer theory about this from Mark.
So thank you, Georg. We will now go a little bit deeper into the peer-to-peer details of StormWorm, of the communication. I think for some of you who perhaps spent some time or read something about the StormWorm, some papers or the diploma thesis that was done on this bot, you already know the stuff that I'm going to tell you. But nevertheless, we have a huge audience here, so we have to talk about this again. StormWorm uses some components for its communication, and these are the components. It's the OVNET protocol they use, so it was used in eDonkey, and it uses the Kademlia DHT algorithm for routing over this protocol. So they were using the OVNET infrastructure of eDonkey, so they at first just used the same protocol with no encryption as eDonkey did use it, so they had they could reuse the infrastructure of that and start with a few amount of nodes, and they didn't have to have a huge network where routing is perfect at the start. And then later, when they had enough nodes, they changed to use encryption. To the usage of encryption, so they separated their P2P network from the eDonkey network, and this was done by simply using a static SOAR key that is in the binary in each StormWorm binary, and by this they encrypted they just SOARed the packets, and so normal eDonkey nodes would not be able to recognize the packets that are coming, and so they have a really separate network. And you can be sure that if you get packets that are encrypted by this XOR key and you decrypt them and look at them and you see the bytes, yeah, we see this on the next slide, I think. No, not on the next slide, but then you can be sure that this is a Storm node really that you are getting packets from. So the second thing is. The Kademlia DHT algorithm, just here's a slide for a short overview over DHT. So DHT is a distributed hash table where nodes and content are identified by hashes. So it provides some means of routing and finding content or other nodes through searching for some specific hashes. And these hashes we have this on the next slide. Are of 128-bit length in this Kademlia DHT algorithm. So you have a structured key-based routing, and then in a DHT, each node is responsible for a part of the key space. So if you want to place some content there, then it, some node is responsible for that content, and the lookup will end up, a lookup for this content will end up at this node, and this node then knows how to retrieve the content. And this is the same, or this technique is used by Storm. Yeah, this is a cool stuff because you can efficiently search in this network. You have a search complexity of log n if you use a storage of log n, but that's probably just a fact for you here. Kademlia is this DHT routing algorithm, 128-bit identifiers for nodes and content. And it uses SOAR as its distance metric. So if you want to know how far away are you from a certain hash or from a certain node, then you just XOR them, and then you have the most significant bit that differs is the XOR distance then. This is really important because, as you will see later, this XOR distance metric and the DHT, how it is working, is the basic or the first step in our attack, and the first step that is, kind of vulnerable so that we can use it and exploit it. If a node wants to join a network, then it needs to bootstrap it. Every Storm node knows some nodes in the there's a peers list in the binary itself, so they know some nodes that are probably up when a machine is infected. So then it connects. Yeah, it sends messages to this node. We will see the specific messages in a few seconds, and then with these bootstrapping methods, it populates its routing tables. And these routing tables, they have in Kademlia, they have 128 buckets. So we have 128 bit identifiers, and one for each distance you can have from one hash. You have a bucket that you store some nodes of that specific distance in. So if you want to look, I think we have it on the next slide. I'm a little bit too fast here. Okay, so here, this is the thing why we need these 128 buckets. So if you want to find a certain hash X, then the node that wants to find this hash queries the peers that are closest to X according to the XOR metric. So it looks up in this routing table. The hash I want to find is of distance 100. So I look in my bucket 100. If I have some nodes in there, if I haven't, I go some buckets away, and then I choose other nodes. But basically, I want to send my queries the nearest possible nodes. And then these nodes that I send the queries to, they respond with more peers nearer to the target again. Or they respond with you can send, if they are near enough, you can send it a direct search query, and then you get the search result. So by this algorithm, it is ensured that each iteration will find nodes closer to the key. So it actually will not go into an endless loop or whatever. This is a little example, picture of this. So here we have a node AAA, and if it wants now to find some hash FFFF, for example, then it will ask some node that it knows that is nearer to the hash, or some other node, and this node then responds with some other node that is nearer to the hash, and so on. So we just skip through this. It's basically just the same as I just said. So in the end, it will end up at the node F000, and this node will probably, in this example, it is near enough, so then this node is can tell you where to find your content. And then this is a search algorithm. So this is basics of DHT. This was the basics of DHT, and now some deeper insight into the protocol itself. As it is overnet, it uses UDP/IP, and each message starts with 2 bytes. It's the hexadecimal 0xE3. This is the eDonkey magic number for messages, and then there's an opcode of the message, and we have different message types, as we see in the next slides. And this is, of course, if you just see some packets on the network, this is of course XORed then with this encryption, so you don't see the E3 directly on the wire, but you have to decrypt, and then you see E3, so you can check if it is a valid eDonkey message. And some in this overnet protocol, a peer consists of its MD4 hash. It's this is the identifier. Then it has an IP and port, and it also has a peer type, which is actually, most of the time I think it was zero in our findings, but it could be used to distinguish between peers. So we have several messages for maintaining connectivity and getting connectivity, and there is the publicize message type that just says hello, are you there? Then the node, if it is actually there, then the node which you sent this message to, it acts the message, and then you know, okay, there is somebody on the other side. I send him a connect. And a connect is basically a second hello that is then responded to with a list of peers. So this is used to gain connectivity in this network. You send to other nodes, you send connect messages, and they give you back some other nodes they know and they are connected to. So you can populate your routing tables. This is used in the bootstrapping sequence. There's also a message identify. You can use it to enumerate other peers' information. This is, for example, good to know to check if you're behind a network address translation, as if another peer says, I am at IP 0000, or I have a local area network IP, then it's probably behind a network address translation. So identify reply, it contains this information. Then you have more messages for the search. For the search algorithm, there's the search message type. This is initiating a search for some hash. So you send search query by this message type to other nodes. These nodes then have, then respond with search next messages. They contain, again, more peers that are for them in their routing tables are nearer to the target hash. And if you are near enough, or if the target node that you're querying is near enough to the hash that you're searching, you don't send a search, but you send a get search result directly. So you say, you are very near to my target that I want to find, so give me the search results, and then is this actually not on the slide, but there's a message type that is says no result, so the node can then respond with a result, or say, I have no result, ask somebody else. And this search result message actually is there multiple times. So you get, if you say get search result, you get multiple search result messages, and then after the other node is done with that, you get a search end message. This is again a little picture to emphasize this. It's really easy. Node publicizes, it gets an ACK, it connects, it gets some peers back from connect reply. This is done to several peers, of course. And then if you want to search something, you send a search. And now if the node B is far from your target, according to the XOR metric again, then you get search next with other peers. And if node B is near to the peer, then you send a get search result, and you get multiple search results back, and then you get a search end back. Now I have a little picture of Wireshark of actual communication with such a node. So it's just to repeat or to show you that this is actually what happens. You have in the top the publicized messages. Actually, you have the publicized messages multiple times and also the connect messages, because you want to maintain connectivity and you want to stay connected to the node so that it does not push you out of its routing tables and stuff. So you have to, or the nodes actually, they send their messages multiple times. They are their publicizers. And if you would now look into this this eDonkey UDP search message, then we would see the actual one of the hashes that Storm uses to find its command and control servers. So these are the messages that we are interested in, and also all the guys that put StormWorm into a sandbox. They filtered for these search messages and then saw the search hashes that are in the end ending up at the with a result that contains the CNC server. And this as Georg already said, this the search hash that Storm actually searches for is generated in a kind of obfuscated fashion in Storm. So the people put the Storm into their sandboxes and didn't reverse engineer it, but we did, and we can give you the code for that. And this is cool to monitor it, and also to this is important to our attack. So now the interesting part, probably for everyone, the cool things. The vulnerability is the first thing of the vulnerability is the possibility to do a SIP attack in a DHT network, in a DHT routing. So you can, because of the fact that nodes try to route their search queries to the nearest peers to their search target, you can through the Sybil attack announce yourself to a specific node that you want to intercept search queries from. You can announce yourself with a hash that is really near to the target hash that it will search for. So if we know node B, the storm node will search for hash F or FX, and we say we are FA, then it probably will send its request to us. So this is the first thing that is important. The second thing is that the command and control server, it's encoded in the search result, and this was as we know not reverse engineered until now. So Felix did spend much time in the code and in the assembly, and then he found out how actually the search results can be decoded into the command and control server port and IP that we have to connect to. And this also is for our exploit and for our overtake. This is really for our takeover. It's really important because we can, if we intercept search queries, we can give them back search results that actually give them not the real command and control server, but give them our command and control server, and we can lure them into connecting to us instead of connecting to the real command and control. Third thing, we already said that, but so storm searches for 32 pre-computable hashes per day. This is missing here. It's actually dependent on the time. So these 32 hashes, they change with time. So you have to each day you have different 32 hashes, but they are pre-computable, and we can just do a little code, a little C program, and we actually have that computes these 32 hashes, and then you can. Then you can search for these hashes to monitor, or you can announce yourself with hashes near these 32 and then intercept all the search queries and give them your own command and control server. This is important to mention because if you normally would like to intercept the search queries in this network, you would have to introduce 10,000 or more to 2 to the power of 16, I think, was mentioned in some talk, nodes into the network to intercept all search queries over the network. And this is certainly, for a takeover, this is not really cool because you don't have this high bandwidth and this many machines. So we don't need that. We just, can use these 32 hashes to put ourselves in the place for interception of the search queries. And this can be done with one machine and one single script or process. Basically, here a little picture. We will introduce ourselves to the network. We will publicize and connect into the network with a hash that is, if we think of the example that we had before, that is basically the F001, because the search queries will end up at us, and we can then give them our search result instead of the real one. This is basically about the peer-to-peer workings, and now, the interesting stuff and work to scope of reverse engineering.
Okay. Okay. Right. Hello. Yes. Okay. I got some sound. All right. So much about the details. What you have to keep in mind is Storm uses peer-to-peer to get the command server. You can think about this being any file. The files are represented by hashes, as Mark said. So if you hear the term search hash, you can think about your favorite peer-to-peer tool and a search for any file like my favorite porn.avi or whatever, right? There's one thing about our source code, because all the stuff is already implemented. You don't have to re-implement it yourself. And those guys have used the catc library. Anybody here a developer of the catc library? Lucky you. Because I've reversed the library and found out that it is catc they are using. And then I said, wow, this is cool, so I can have a look at the source code. But actually, it was easier to look at the binary than the source code. And I'm not the only one thinking that, because the developers of Storm, you know, they include this encryption, as Mark mentioned. And what they did is they added this encryption just before the send and removed it afterwards because they couldn't understand what's happening somewhere else in this library, right? So nobody understands that except probably the developers, I hope at least. Okay, I'd like to show you some details about the reverse engineering. If there are people here that are into reverse engineering, some of the stuff is not so new, it's just standard, but my motivation is to get people into reverse engineering that are not already. All right? So if you find all the stuff interesting I'm telling now, come to our workshop tonight and we can show you a little more tricks. All right? Oh, which room is it? It's starting at 8 o'clock? A3. Well, we are there for questions, but we only have 10 seats. All right? Okay. The first thing you need for reverse engineering is best to have something that you can run in a debugger or disassembling program. My favorite is IDA Pro, as is the favorite of many other people. You should definitely get a copy of the free version if you want to start analyzing executables. And the debugger is crap, but what's cool is browsing the executables. And we used it to do the static analysis of Storm, which means that we looked at the binary and what's happening there, control flow and stuff, without executing it in IDA. And then you can rename variables and functions and whatever. And it's pretty cool to browse through the source code. When I mean source code, it's assembly. Okay, so what we tried first is we built a decryptor for Storm in order to, when a new version is coming out, so that we can get a fresh copy of the code and have a look at it. Then we came across some hints from others, that we can just do a memory dump and reconstruct the import table, and it worked well. Because Storm is loading the whole executable in memory after unpacking, even with their headers. Okay, there's a second tool you need, which is a debugger. Because you may discover the logic using a disassembler, but you cannot really have a look at what values are inside the variables and stuff. This is pretty hard and takes a lot of time if you want to do it with just a static analysis tool. So what we did is we linked all the information we got from IDA, from our manual analysis, static analysis, and used them in the Immunity debugger. So that we got all the information from our static analysis tools in the Immunity debugger, which is a lot helpful if you can use names there and stuff. And here comes the cool stuff. Because all the stuff, all the Storm code, is extracted into heap memory and run in heap memory. All right? And there's only one point where you can be sure that breakpoints stay where they are. And this is right after the start, right after unpacking. So we have built a small decryptor stub and a script that's watching Storm as it's getting unpacked. And once it's unpacked, we can install everything we want. And we used it for breakpoints, patches, and all other stuff like VM detection, patching out, and stuff. All right. Those are two screenshots of Lord P, which we use for dumping. And the only thing you have to do is find the right memory region, the heap memory region, and reconstruct the import table. And then for Storm, this is only for Storm, not if you want to do general reverse engineering. But for Storm, it works very well. You get the whole executable. And even with some import or function or external references. Okay, but back to the main topic, as Mark has mentioned, we need some search hash to find the control server. And this is what Storm does. It looks for a specific hash, like any file, and the response or the answer to the search, the search result, is telling you where the command server is located. And we need that in order to inject our own command server. For the older versions of Storm, with which we started, this was pretty hard because somebody had used a POSIX library that was linked, which was a Windows port, and they did some very fucked up operations. Newer versions, they are using the MSV CRT library, and it's straightforward. You can read everything out of there. And I suspect that Joe Stewart had to wait for publishing his details for so long because he could just read out the simple stuff, but I'd like to talk to him personally on that. Okay, what we did differently than others, we re-implemented all this in C because we wanted to take over Storm. So in order to be efficient, we had to do some debugging. We patched out all the timeouts, even some control sequences, so that we can come to the interesting parts more quickly. And we monitored the relevant functions. For example, send, when things are sent out to the network, so that we can intercept, check is this the stuff we want to monitor, and if so, we looked at where are the buffers, like for example on the stack, and could crawl through the binary. Okay, as I said, the old stuff is pretty complicated. I wanted to show it to you, like this is our disassembly. There was some strange function, mixTime. And what we could identify very easily was that the whole buffer that is used after this mix time is XORed. All elements are XORed together and all elements are added together. And this is how some excerpt from mix time. And there are strange numbers. At first we thought, okay, this is some kind of encryption. But if you have a closer look, you will see that get system time is giving you the nanoseconds since 1601, the year 1601, and Storm wants to use Unix time. All right, so this is just some simple conversion, but it was easy to find a candidate, but all the stuff and seeing the logic behind it was pretty hard at first. It's a lot easier if you have a look at the newer versions, right? There's just a call to time, and then you can see the days, years, month, day of week, and so are put into a buffer and XORed and added together. Okay, this is illustrated here. So what we need is we need the day, the weekday, month, year, low and high byte, and there's two checksums done on that. Furthermore, there are some pretty strange operations, like two of those date informations are divided, they are multiplied, modded, and so on. And this doesn't really make any sense. So it's just for obfuscation. And what was that question? Seems not. And the point is why this is working is because, this is actually the good point about Storm. Let's start differently. You know, the guys that are normally affected by Storm are not the elite computer users. And you know what's the biggest problem for those guys? Keeping their time in sync, right? And actually, Storm does that for them, right? So isn't that a great feature? Come on! All right, and Storm has to do this because the hashes have to be the same for all hosts across the world, right? And they are all getting the GM time, which is the same for all hosts in the world. And so all hosts for a specific day have the same hashes. Then you take specific information, do some stupid integrity checks like XOR all the elements, add all the elements, which is just some obfuscation and some other strange stuff. And at the end, you use a static XOR key to encrypt the stuff. All right? If this is really encryption or not, I'm leaving this to you. Actually, it's a symmetric key encryption, but it's not very valuable. All right. As mentioned before, there are 32 different. And this is because of a random value that's at the end added to all those elements. And that's the whole magic. Here's the C code. As mentioned before, no need to take out your notepads and write it down now because we are publishing that, okay? So we implemented that and looked at where do the hashes lead. Can we have other peers connect to us because we are very close to the hash? And what about the hash results? But the problem was at that point, the hashes didn't lead to any hosts we knew, right? So there were the search hashes which we could answer. We could be the closest, the best ones close to that hash. So we could practically say, we know where the file is that you need, all right? If the file is similar as the command control server. Okay, so what we found out is that there is no correlation between the result that gets returned after the search and the actual command and control server that is used. So there must be some information in the result that redirects all the bots to some other server. Okay, this gets us to the second hash we are going to look at, result hashes, because you're not getting an IP address in overnet or a port or whatever, you're getting a hash as a result. And so we had a closer look at those hashes. And in order to get some useful information about those hashes, we used a debugger and did some data flow tracking on the static part to find the position, to find the function inside this original storm where this stuff is parsed and what happens there. Once we found this function, it was maybe half an hour work or maybe an hour to get C code out of that. We had to redo it a few times because of the Kademlia library, catc, because it's using so many threads that you get totally confused by looking at it, right? So we had to do this again and again and restart the debugger, and to be a bit faster, we patched out some timeouts that Storm is using and the control flow, which we knew could be stepped over. And what we got as a result is that of the hashes, the result hashes, okay, that's not the search hashes, that's the result hash we are getting back. The upper four bits are always random. They're just crap. They are not used at all. In the zero bits of each byte in the hash, there's a checksum. The lower eight bits are a sum checksum, all elements added together. The upper eight bits are an XOR checksum. In the one bits, we got the port the client is connected to. So this is the actual port of the command and control server. And bits 2 and 3 is the IP address of the command and control server. And the whole thing is encoded using the same static XOR key as the search queries. So the Storm guys implemented one static XOR key encryption and used it everywhere, right? Easy for us. Okay, here is the whole thing a little illustrated. I'm sorry for the colors. I lost some slides and had to redo them very quickly. I hope you're not getting blind now. Okay, so the bit number 4 is having the IP low bit. Then the next bit 3 has IP high bit. Here's the port and here's the checksum. So this is how it works. And knowing all this, right, this is the C code, knowing all this, we were able to tell the bots where to connect to get commands. All right? First, we injected the search hashes, saying, we know the results, we know where your command and control server is located, and then we said, okay, the command and control server is our machine. And this is the actual code, which you don't have to write down, you know. Okay, and what happens then is, the bot connects to the server we announced using TCP. There's a challenge response, another XOR key. This one is different now. And if this response is correct, the server is answering our requests. Okay, the whole thing is really highly encrypted. I don't know if you know the zlib encryption, right? Who of you does not know zlib encryption? Okay, zlib is just a packer, right? They just pack all the stuff. It's plain text ASCII what they send. What's interesting about it is that the bots or zombies, they pull the information. So they're asking the server, do you have any news for me? If so, please send them. Then the server sends back. But the server is not giving the commands. It's actually the client asking for commands. Old versions had like around 12 commands. Newer versions have 14. I'm not sure if we got the latest, but our last sample is from like somewhere September, October. Maybe there are newer commands. I have to admit, we have worked on... Okay, the question is if they had used proper encryption, like public key encryption, authentication, right? The whole thing would not be possible. Well, what we could do is we could still connect because we know all the client stuff, right? We could authenticate to the server. But what we wanted to do is we want to implement the server, and that would not have been possible then. Because we would have needed the keys on the server. This is for all the hackers out there that then see a machine and maybe hijack that machine, get down the keys from the commanding server and whatever. But the problem here is also that the commanding servers are also peers. They are not the ones that are controlled by the owners of the botnet. So it wouldn't be any use to have the keys inside one of those command servers, because they could be hijacked as well, because they are just peers like all the others, right? But still, the commands could have been signed, and that would have made it very much harder for us. Okay, here's how the protocol looks like after zlib encryption. Okay, first the client sends some hello message saying, okay, hello, my name is my computer. This is the actual computer name. I'm running Windows XP Service Pack 2, and my ID is this up there. And then the server answers, okay, your external host name is this, and this is your IP address. So always nice to know if you're netted or whatever to get your outside IP address. Okay, this has been known before, this handshake and the zlib encryption, because you can black box that. Then there's a second command, which also has a number 2. There's number 2, the same ID and some other stuff, which is not so important here. And what all the guys that have black boxed have always seen is a 1 and colon. No, what's? Exclamation mark. Thank you. So a 1 and an exclamation mark. That's all that they've ever seen. So they thought, okay, it's probably part of the hello, like a second stage or whatever. We will come to that point on the next slide. Okay, the next step is to request the DDoS targets. So right now that we are the command server, we could DDoS anybody who we don't like. And the best is we can send spam, right? Right. We haven't done that yet because I don't know any good text and I'm not a good writer. So if you have a good text, please come to me and we can have a look if we... What? All right, Mrs. Christmas, maybe the original executable, right? So this number 2 was somehow suspicious to us. It had no use at all and nobody knew what it was for. So we had a closer look into the assembly source code. And there was some strange update thing. Right, the string update is found at multiple places there. But here it was somehow suspicious, and at that point, we could also identify the functions for all commands that are sent out. Right, so we were pretty far ahead during that phase. And by injecting fake responses into memory, we didn't even have to wait for or fake real command servers. We could just go to that point in the code and check what's happening there. And so we just altered the control flow to get to this point only. And if you have a look, at this point, it's already pretty obvious what's happening. Okay, pretty obvious if you know how to adjust all the blocks, because I didn't have time to adjust them, sorry. So the first thing that is done is here on the right, from your point of view on the right, there's a string copy happening to update. Okay, sounds very interesting. If this is really update, and there are some other conditions that are true, there's an HTTP download command that is executed. And with this binary, there's a create process call afterwards. And this sounded very, very interesting to us. So we tried that, and we were pretty successful, right? So after knowing the search hash and telling everybody we know the results to the searches you are doing, then in the results saying, okay, this is the server you need to connect to. And then when they connect, we just send the update. And this update is really run on the machine. So we could inject like any executable we wanted to into the system. And now the point is, once you're on the machine, you want to remove the old storm worm, because they may upload binaries too. And so then it's a war. Which binary is the strongest and is harder to disinfect and stuff. So the first thing we do is when entering a machine is to disinfect it, right? Remove the old storm worm. And, there's a question?
Yeah, just stages,
right.
You mentioned there was randomness in the search hash generation.
Right.
Is that like a primitive form of load balancing? Although not all the hosts were there, when the botnet was a lot bigger.
Right, okay. The question was, why are those hashes really random? Well, there are 32 different hashes the bots are searching for, and if this is some kind of load balancing, that's the question. It's putting less load on the overall DHT, but it would also be possible, I think, even with just one hash. But right, everybody's asking the same notes then. Okay, maybe we can take this discussion afterwards, right? Because Georg disagrees, and we have to fight this out internally before we get the boxing equipment, and while Till is telling you how to disinfect from Storm. Thank you.
Okay, is it working? Okay, here comes the final part. So now we know how to gain control over a storm peer. And as Felix already said, now the question is, what can we possibly send to a storm peer and execute there? And the goal is, of course, to terminate running instances. So there might be even several instances running of different versions of Storm on one machine. The one thing we observed is that if you download Storm, a Storm sample from one of the web pages, for instance, the Dancing Skeleton page, if you download the Storm sample from there, you get samples with different checksums. So it's some sort of polymorphism is implemented there. I think it's not that you get a unique sample each time you download it, but it's at least we have several thousands of different samples. So what we cannot do is we cannot unpack it and do stuff with it. So our strategy is we must enumerate all processes running on the system and check whether they are Storm or not to identify the processes which we want to terminate. And our strategy is that we scan the memory of each process and by calling read process memory and then perform a simple pattern matching. And then we have to be careful, because some versions of Storm inject threads into services exe or explorer exe. And in these cases, we cannot simply terminate the process, because if you terminate services exe, you terminate Windows, and this is not what we want. So in that case, we have to we have to identify the image on disk. We have to mark it so that it gets deleted upon the next reboot. And then we have to, the other case. Anyway, we have to, if we can identify an image on disk, we have to delete it upon the next reboot. But in the case of a standalone process, we can simply terminate it. And if it's an injected thread, we need to, terminate the thread. And this is done by injecting some kind of shellcode into the code segment of the thread. I guess I have a different slide. Yeah. The distinct pattern, the unique pattern, which can be used to identify a storm thread or a storm process is the XOR key. It is 40 bytes long, so we have a very low false positive rate, as shown in the formula at the bottom of the slide. And we assume that it's safe to simply scan for this pattern in the process memory, and if we find it, we can safely assume that it's storm. this is the histogram of the XOR key. Georg, you made it, and I guess you wanted to show that it's results in the few false positives. Here's an example memory map. We see services access with different threads. Some have a PE header, some data sections, code sections, and at the bottom there's a standalone process. And we can now run through all memory sections and search for the XOR key by we implemented the Boyer-Muth string matching algorithm because it's known to be one of the faster ones, and so we can now identify the threads and processes which are storm. And here is a shellcode we inject into a thread because, as I said before, a process can simply be terminated. And if you can guess which tool made this pretty graph, Marcus, you don't count, then you might be a candidate for one of the beers. What? Which tool created the dot file? No, which tool created the dot file? Yeah, right. Okay, you get the beer. We reused existing shellcode here, which does some PEB location thing for the exit thread AP call, and then finally calls it so that the current thread terminates itself. What we do is we spread an NOPSLED over the whole code section of the identified thread and place this little piece of shellcode at the very end of the code section. Okay, here are the final slides. I want to say a few words about how you can actually take over the storm botnet. What you can do with our approach is you can take over the network from a single machine. But if you would do that, you would probably get an implicit DDoS because you receive so many connecting, overnet messages that you basically cannot handle it. So you DDoS yourself in an implicit manner. But you would probably also get explicitly DDoS because there are most likely some people which are pissed off and, would DDoS you. But if you want to make that experience yourself, you can use the code we will be publishing maybe tonight or tomorrow once we figured out how to attach it to an email. Okay, and the next step is what we thought about: how can you prevent from being DDoS, prevent the DDoS attacks. You can take over Storm in a distributed manner. We already have a peer-to-peer network by hand, so you could recursively disinfect it. We could start with one node, which is marked red here, and this node can then inject the manipulated hashes itself and automatically take over different further nodes. So the next step would be it would take over these nodes, and these would take over other nodes. So you will recursively take over the storm network, and this is smart. This is fast, and it's not ready yet. So, (clears throat) actually, you have to blame Felix because he didn't finish the reverse engineering part, which is important for that part. Okay, now we come to the interesting part of the talk. We will give you a short demonstration how to take over a storm running in a virtual machine.
Right, because I need some time to prepare the setup, maybe Georg can answer the question from here. The question was, why are there 32 different hashes?
Yeah. So it results in some kind of load balancing. We don't know if they originally did it because of that, but it results in load balancing. Because if you think about DHT again, what Mark explained is that DHT works in a way you approach the node with a hash closest to the hash you're searching. And if you only have one hash that you're searching for, all nodes searching for that one hash will in the end all be approaching the same peer in the routing algorithm. So having 32 different hashes that are being searched for, this means that you're approaching 32 different hashes. This also happens in the original overnet network, where you actually have like hashes for keywords. So if you have the hash of the word the simple word the nodes that have an ID close to this hash always get a lot of load because these nodes have to get all the cache all the results for files that have the in their file name. So actually, this is a kind of load balancing then.
All right. So let's start with the demo. We wanted to show you that we are not using a patched version of Storm, but we are using a real version. And unfortunately, Storm has some timeouts, so you got to wait a bit. It all takes 3 minutes. I hope you have 3 minutes left, dear. All right. All right. What you see here is our Storm sniffer. We've written a small tool that scans. Does a PCAP capture or a network capture of all the storm traffic and writes out the messages. And I've already started in this window our so-called storm fucker, right? And this storm fucker is announcing 32 hashes to the peer we want to overtake. Okay, this is a test setup just for sure, but we've tested in the real storm botnet, and we can assure you can really take over nodes. I don't have internet connection. It's just a local setup, all right? So as you see, every 5 seconds, all 32 hashes are announced by our storm fucker. And now I'm using this virtual machine here to start the real storm. And as you see here now, msurf.exe is the storm node that's running now. And what you will see is we are using calc.exe, which you know, Windows calculator, renamed to verifier.exe and upload this. And once this pops up, we know that we have overtaken the node, right? Because our storm fucker for sure is silent as well. You wouldn't see anything, and we want to show you something. Okay, what you will see in a few moments here is the real storm node getting active. And it will send publicized messages as well and connect messages to join the peer-to-peer network and also some other messages like get my external IP address and stuff. All right, here it is. And what you see in our storm fucker output over here is parts of the hash of the node that is connecting to us, to the network. Okay, which is 3347 and so on, but which is not the search hash, but just the hash of the node. Okay, here you see all the messages that are happening. You see there's lots of things happening if you have peer-to-peer. It's all UDP messages. Okay, let's get back to the virtual machine. In a few seconds, the searches should be starting, because at first, in the first 60 seconds, there's just some connection phase, bootstrap phase, to get the node into the real peer-to-peer network, to get connectivity to as many nodes as possible. And only after that, the searches are starting. So, and this should begin. Right, takes a little longer. Actually, that's the bootstrap. Oh, okay, here we go. Here we get the searches. And because we are simulating 32 different nodes with 32 different hashes, we are getting lots of traffic and lots of search requests. And now Storm is collecting those search replies that we are sending back from different nodes, and zoop, there it is, right? All right, what if I tell you that I've installed a cron job here? All right, now here's the verify exe which we uploaded here, and if I terminate this, the calc will close, so it's not the original calc. It's not a proof, but I hope you believe me at this point. Okay, there's one last myth I want to show you. There are lots of researchers that did black box testing and saying, okay, Storm is now using an encrypted protocol. And those this protocol always starts with a hex 29 or 29 or lower values. Actually, it's not encrypted, even though its entropy is very high. And the entropy is very high because it's random data, right? Storm is using this to do timing measurements to find the commanding peer that's closest to it. And, well, I guess that's the thing most people think is encrypted because of its high entropy. Okay, thank you so much for listening. Are there any questions? Yeah. Right, because the first six people asking questions get a beer.
I think two are already taken.
Okay, I think you were the first over there. Oh, no, I got to get the microphone. Okay, then over here. Okay, sorry, hard to see. Right.
About authentication again.
Right.
If the commands were signed, then you could do this, right?
Right. If they were like public, private key encrypted, we couldn't do anything.
Can I have...
Sure.
Okay, so actually there's a lot of researchers that say there is RSA public key authentication in StormWorm. And actually there it is believed, I mean, we didn't find anything of this, so it's, but we didn't look at all code, or Felix didn't look at all code. But there are some researchers that say there's RSA, and the code path that is supposed to be authenticated by RSA is what turns a normal node into a controlling node. So only the StormWorm people can activate command and control nodes, actually. And these then start proxying these command and control connections. But we don't, so the public key authentication is one layer above the layer we're attacking, because we're just saying, oh, we're the command control layers, nodes on the peer-to-peer level. So they actually should have just signed the commands instead of signing who is the command and control server. So we could circumvent this if there's actually RSA, because we didn't ever see it. This is just what we read on some papers.
There was a question
in
the back over there. Right.
Hi. Terrific job you've been doing there. First of all, what kind of measures have you been taking to prevent your botnet to be re-overtaking?
We haven't... Actually, that's details, huh?
Right. First of all, we do not maintain our own botnet. This is... we have implemented measures to re-overtake it afterwards. So our implementation has several buffer overflows, possibly, for sure, and we can use these to regain control. So should we consider this to be a smart question, worth a beer, or yeah, come to the front and get your beer?
You said earlier that you didn't think the Storm botnet was written by Russians, but you thought that it might have had American cultural origins. Can you elaborate on that, please?
So this is not our assumption. So that's, as I've said, there's a lot of research, and this was actually public research. So what I don't know who said, but there was someone else. Most of the servers that you're connecting to actually are in Russia, but they are assumed to be proxies because the actual email campaigns, the spam campaigns, are very well adjusted to American culture. So it's believed that the physical persons running this are Americans or might be some Western-oriented, maybe Germans. Whoever, because...
Not
for sure, no. How do we all know this stuff? Anyway, so because it's targeted on Halloween and Christmas and strippy Christmas, so probably, I don't know, some person from a very conservative country with conservative religion might not have chosen a stripping center because you don't have Santa in that culture, Santa Claus, or some stuff like this. So they're believed to be some Western-oriented country, and yeah, maybe it's even Russians. You can't tell that for sure because they did a good stuff, good job at hiding, because that's also, besides peer-to-peer has advantage, you cannot take it down. It's also very hard to track the person that gives the commands if you do it properly.
Right. Do you come forward to get your beer?
Do you have any idea why they didn't use the hash of IP and port of for the nodes to generate the nodes ID, as it is common in many DHTs, because that would circumvent exactly your attack to place yourself close to the hashes that are searched for?
So basically, to do this properly, you need to know your external IP address. And to get your external IP address in the overnight protocol, you need to already have a hash. And actually, or you enumerate your local IPs, but that doesn't work if you're netted.
When you bootstrap your node, you're on the first contact to your bootstrapping node. Your bootstrapping node could tell you your external IP.
Yeah, but this doesn't work for the... So if you design the protocol accordingly, this is okay, but okay. In the overnet protocol, this doesn't work like this. So you would have to first send... So the message that gets you your external IP already contains your own hash, and this is then first announced. So this doesn't work. And also, the other thing is that for DHT to work, you want to have a uniformly distributed hash, a ring of hashes. And if you want to have a uniformly distributed ring, and this is your only requirement, then just do it randomly. That's statistically, if you have enough nodes, this is uniformly distributed, of course.
Okay. My question is meant to be serious. Is it legal to clean a host by your methods?
No. Well, no, and we didn't do that on hosts we didn't own. Plus, there is some countries where it might be legal for certain persons. So
that's why we are. That's why we only cleaned up our own hosts. All right, but it's working.
Have you searched how the commands come to the command service in Shane? You know, they got that come from somewhere.
Sorry.
You have command service, but where do those service get the commands from?
Right. We are still reversing on the full thing. Right? You can be a potential command server if you are not network address translated. Right? And if you're not network address translated and you know any other command server, you connect to this command server telling him that you're not network address translated, and you open some specific ports on which you can accept commands, right? And we suspect that those information are propagated throughout the peer-to-peer network to specific hosts, right? There are also some information from the black boxes. We are still reversing on the full protocol. Some more details are found in different black box papers as far as I know. Not on the actual protocol, but on the network relations. And was?
Okay, I have a question. How much damage could you realistically do to the Storm botnet? I mean, what percentage of nodes do you think you could destroy if you just attacked now? And why wouldn't you do that?
Could you stand up and raise the question again?
Okay, so if you wanted to attack Storm botnet today, what percentage of the nodes do you think you could take down?
As Felix said before, there's a tiny part of the protocol we didn't reverse engineer yet. So we are pretty sure that we could take over all NUTTED nodes, so all nodes which are behind network address translation, which is probably the majority of the nodes.
Or do you want to have numbers? because that's the problem. The size of the storm botnet varies a bit, right? I think the largest we have seen is like 40,000 nodes, right?
Yeah, I think so.
At once, 40,000 nodes. So we can take up to 40,000 nodes, which should be enough for any DDoS, right?
Yeah, it's important to understand that we didn't implement a tracker, so we don't crawl the storm botnet and count peers. So we can only estimate the number of peers.
Okay. G'day. Okay, so now, guys, you have a lot of experience with vulnerabilities of botnets. My question is, do you plan to publish documents or paper with recommendation and security advices how to propose really secure botnet network?
So to write your own good, secure, peer-to-peer botnet, well, I have to be sure I'm not getting into 202C, the German paragraph here. Use public key authentication. For example, if you would strip down OpenSSL and compile it for Windows, ECC public key encryption is only 50 kilobytes more to the binary in theory, probably. And also, don't use DHT actually. If you use an unstructured P2P approach, because you just want to flood out.
And also, regarding one of the earlier questions, about the legality and the legal aspects of that. If we push out the code for all the parts that were missing up until now in the research, and we push out code to overtake a node, then perhaps there is some more gray or black hat guy who would clean up the botnet or whatever, do whatever with it. But we won't take over the botnet, so.
So if we release the cleanup code and the distributed cleanup stuff, maybe someone else pushes the button, but we won't, because it's illegal in Germany. And even the releasing the code with all pieces is illegal because of the infamous 202C, so because you can take over a computer with this, so we won't be releasing only bits and pieces and someone else has to assemble this. But maybe someone else will post it to the mailing list in the following days, who knows?
So much for the disclaimer.
Yeah, how long did it take to use the whole research, and especially the part of reverse engineering?
So the question was how long did it take us?
How long did it take? Yeah.
Okay, there's a great new law in Germany which is called parental leave, and you get paid for that. And I had some time because, let's say it took us about 2 months to get through like 80% of the code.
Yeah, we actually started doing this in April this year, but the summer was hot and we had different things to do. So we did the final parts of reverse engineering right here in the Hack Center downstairs.
Right.
Yeah.
So. So the motivation to start in April was when we saw the talk of the University of Mannheim. They used 2 to the power of 16 nodes to disturb the botnet. We said, okay, we can't overtake the whole botnet with just one node. This was our motivation. I think it was last year on this Congress, and in April we saw the talk, and then we said, well, maybe we can do better.
Yeah, but it's definitely orders of magnitude is definitely more weeks than months, and definitely not years. So it's not that hard, but it's you have to dig deep. So
other questions?
Could you maybe upload the Christmas calendar as well, just for researching and debugging it?
Yeah. Samples are available from what is it called? That one site, you know.
From the San Diego University, I guess.
There's some site, just Google for it. There's a site that has a lot of malware binaries if you just register, which is kind of unethical if you ask me, but you can get it from there.
Yeah, we unfortunately lost a wiki in the meantime. We documented all our stuff in a wiki and put PCAPs there and samples and IDA files, but we lost it. Otherwise, we would provide it to you, but yeah. Now you get the code. Other questions? No more questions? Okay.